I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us, some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Richard Seaberth, translator, scholar, essayist, editor, among whose great editions of Ezra Pound are The New Directions, Pisan Cantos, and the masterful Library of America Poems and Translations, who was the leading force behind the making of Penn Sound's Pound Page and author of Penn Sound's Listener's Guide to those recordings, a long, informative essay titled The Sound of Pound. And by Kaplan Harris, who, as a D.C. dweller, co-curated the In Your Ear and Ruthless Grip poetry series, now teaching at St. Bonaventure University, editor with Peter Baker and Rod Smith of the Selected Letters of Robert Creeley, whose recent critical essays can be found in Contemporary Literature, Art Voice, American Literature, Paiduma, and elsewhere. And by Rachel Blau Duplessis, the Brooklyn-born critic and poet whose most recent installment of her long ongoing poem Drafts is Pitch, Drafts 77 and 95, published by Salt in 2010, whose Penn Sound page is a treasure trove of recordings of Drafts as well as lots of other work, and whose Blue Studios poetry and its cultural work I highly recommend. Welcome back to Poem Talk again, Rachel, once again.
Thanks.
Hello. Thanks for coming down from North Philly or Center City or wherever you were prior to this. Kaplan and Richard, welcome to the Writer's House and to Poem Talk for the first time.
Thank you.
Is it really true this is your first time to the Writer's House?
It is. I have downloaded many things from here, but I've never been here
now
myself.
You're actually here. And Richard, thank you on this rainy day for interrupting your sabbatical to join us. Well, today we've gathered to talk about the third canto of Ezra Pound, published in between hardcovers for the first time in 1924-25, Three Mountains Press, draft of 16 cantos, and variously drafted earlier, probably written around 1917. The canto was never recorded by Pound, so far as we know, until the summer of 1967 in Italy. The voice you'll hear is quiet and frail, so we recommend listening along with the printed text. So here now is Ezra Pound reading Canto 3 in 1967.
I sat on the Dogana steps, for the gondolas cost too much that year, and there were not those girls. There was one face in the Vicentoro 20 yards off, howling Stretti. The lit crossbeams that year in the Molossini, and peacocks in Corey's house, or there may have been. Gods float in the azure air, bright gods in Tuscan back before dew was shed. Light and the first light before ever dew was fallen. Panisks and from oak trias and from apple melid through all the wood and the leaves are full of voices a whisper and the clouds bow over the lake and there are gods upon them. And in the water the almond-white swimmers, the silvery water glazes the upturned nipple, as Poggio has remarked, green veins in the turquoise. Or grey steps lead up under the cedars. My Cid rode up to Burgos, up to the studded gate between two towers, beat with his lance butt, and the child came out, una niña de 9 años, to the little gallery over the gate between the towers, reading the writ voce tinula, that no man speak to, feed, help, ruid dias, on pain to have his heart out, set on a pike spike, and both his eyes torn out, and all his goods sequestered. And here, mio Cid, are the seals, the big seal and the writing. And he came down from Bivar, mio Cid, with no hawks left there on their perches, and no clothes there in the presses, and left his trunk with Rachel and Vidas, the big box of sand with the pawnbrokers to get pay for his many, breaking his way to Valencia, Inez de Castro murdered, and a wall here stripped, here made to stand, drear waste, the pigment flakes from the stone, or plaster flakes, Mantegna painted the wall, soot tatters, nec spe, nec metu.
I'd like to do the sort of simple host-like thing of just starting out by saying what the blocks or pieces are, and then invite you to comment. You can go anywhere and invite you to comment on how these things are put together, if they are. We have what seems to be an autobiographical fragment of Pound himself in Venice in 1908. We have the lyric passage of Tuscan prehistory, which seems to be something he sees, a vision of it beyond the steps. We have the Cid arriving at Burgos and subsequently tricking the Jewish merchants, and then the end. I'm not sure that constitutes a separate section, a reference to the murder of Inez de Castro and the mention of drear waste. So I guess the first question I want to ask is, how does the historical method of the cantos work here? And is it simply blocks of historical pieces that just are juxtaposed and don't get stitched together? How do these pieces get delivered? And is this typical of the cantos? A couple of big questions. Richard?
Yeah, well, this is the first time you have the large majuscule I at the beginning of the cantos. This is only the second time that the first pronoun I occurs. In the previous canto, there's an I spoken by Achiotes, who's the pilot of a ship with pirates that are spiriting Dionysus away. But this is clearly, in an epic, this is a very interesting moment, and it's the moment where Pound is talking about the inception of his own career as a poet in the summer of 1908 in Venice, where he publishes Allume Spento. That first section is all in the past tense, I sat, and then we cut to gods float in the azure air. That's all in the present tense, until the next break in the poet, so in the poem. So you move from an autobiographical memory in Venice, you move to kind of a present tense ecstatic eternal, which is actually Pound's impressions of Lake Garda, which is one of his sacred places.
So the question is then, we've got those two sections, what happens, Rachel? How do we, as Richard suggests, we go from one to the other and there's a real shift, but how do we make it to that second piece? And what are readers supposed to do with
Well,
that?
There are a couple of things that one could pick up from what Richard said already, and one was the use of the word epic, which was very casual in your statement, and it may mean simply large, when the cantos in toto are extremely large and long and will have taken, when he doesn't quite finish them, many, many, many decades. That's the so epic. I'd like to return to that, but just simply, we have a kind of multi-temporal set of overlays happening from Greek classical mythology, from Venetian contemporary, to medieval Spain, to Renaissance Italy, to Renaissance Portugal, for that matter, because the last bit is really Portuguese. So,
Inez de Castro.
You know, and there may be a few more in there, but that gives you
there's
the idea.
Slight reference to China as well.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. So there, it's as if there's a series of overlays that can be cited. They can be retellings of things that he has already spoken about in his essays. They can be autobiographical notations. And these overlays you can imagine as being on transparencies, the way in the old technology, typed perhaps on them, and that they slide across each other, and maybe they cross, and maybe you look down through them. It's kind of a palimpsestic with limpidity and condensation. These nodules of crossing are perhaps foreshadowing the ideogrammic method, of which is another promissory note.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kaplan, what do we do with that year, following from what Rachel said? We have he's sitting on yeah. at the gondola platform by the customs house, and the gondolas cost too much that year.
Yeah.
Right? And that year. And then we go to this ethereal gods floating in the azure air, which is not just that year.
It's yeah.
What do we do with this?
Some kind of, you know, eternal thing that's being spoken of. The eye is interesting because he's unable to actually participate in that autobiographical moment. He's just got to sit there and observe things. He doesn't have money in his pocket. There's this weird moment where he refers to the girls, and you think, okay, he's a young Ezra Pound traveling abroad. I mean, that probably was more on his mind at the time than the azure air. And
what was on his mind?
I think looking at the girls.
Unlike Browning, who looks at a lot of them, he only looks at one. Is that some funny thing?
Well, it's this moment. He's like a flaneur. He can't mingle with these people. It's like the Baudelaire moment where he's in the society but outside of it at the same time. He's the American traveler abroad. There's like the overlay of the Henry James moment. You know, what does it mean to put him in this historical moment? How does he connect up with that? So,
Richard, I see what I guess some people call a subject rhyme between a Pound in 1908 and Venice and the Cid returning to Burgos, because in each case they're sort of locked out of mm-hmm. the house, as it were, you know, the great place. They're thwarted, you know. Mm-hmm. So is he in fact, sorry to use this flat word, identifying with the Cid? He wants us to think of himself as Cid-like?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a piece that I have here that he published in 1906, the summer he spent in Maine on a UPenn graduate fellowship.
Not Maine, but Spain.
Spain.
I think in those days, Penn sent people to Spain rather than Maine.
Where he actually visits Burgos, and he talks a great deal about the city, and he kind of rehearses the Cid legend. And what's interesting is that, yes, he's interested in the Cid because he was banished by King Alfonso. He is, therefore, something of an outlaw. He's a wandering soldier of fortune. He's not allowed to come back in the city, and anybody who helps him is going to have their possessions taken and, indeed, their eyes turned out. So, and he's fascinated with him. He kind of prefigures Malatesta as this kind of loose cannon figure of unorganized activity against sort of central authority.
Yeah. Kaplan. And I was just going to say, the first time Cid is mentioned, it's not El Cid or The Cid, but it's My Cid, mm-hmm. Which, I mean, looking at this retrospectively reminds me of My Emily Dickinson, Susan Howe, you know, locating people, historical figures that will somehow give you permission to act or give you some kind of permission for being in the modern world.
So does
that's
the figure
nice, although it's a pun on Mio Cid, which is the
which
Spanish
gets introduced
title.
Later.
But you're right, that kind of appropriation of...
Am I right about the subject rhyme? Both figures are thwarted, so we're supposed to read backwards to Pound sitting on the Dogana steps as someone who really ought to have the ride across to San Marco instead of having to walk all the way around.
Yeah.
Because this is Pound. He should be liberated by the situation.
Yeah.
I sat on the Dogana steps, for the gondolas cost too much that year, and there were not those girls. There was one face in the Vicentoro 20 yards off Howling Stretti. The lit crossbeams that year in the Morosini, and peacocks in Corey's house, or there may have been. Gods float in the azure air, bright gods in Tuscan back before dew was shed. Light and the first light before ever dew was fallen.
There's really a genre circus going on here, and just as there would be in the larger cantos. And so what you get is you do get a lyric eye, really, mm-hmm. and then you get a heroic figure with whom, yes, he does presumably identify. So you get genre pieces, and probably that's not the only genre. There's a kind of elegiac tone. One would be a kind of hyperspace collage.
Yeah.
Another would be encyclopedic. Another would be Tale of the Tribe, sacred book of the, you know, the sacred book of the odes.
Bibliography.
Bibliography. Yeah. I mean, Pound lays down, he kind of deals out cards about what his project is periodically throughout his career. And one of the cards that he deals is, it coheres even if my notes do not cohere. And this is a very late statement. It may be coterminous with the reading of the this tired, poignant reading that we've just heard. And most people focus on the word coheres, which it clearly doesn't,
right.
You know. But I would like to focus for a minute on my notes, which is a genre. And I think that one could argue that among the canto's genre circus, my notes is very important. And I would say that this, Canto 3, is like my notes on certain texts, which he names, as he often does, the footnotes are embedded, which are, and then the question is what the purpose, which we could talk about. I mean, I could, you know, we, anybody.
Yeah. I'll just argue a little bit with you here, since, I mean, I see it as notes, but the way he's putting things next to each other strikes me as manipulative in a way. Like I have to go back to these lines about the...
manipulative?
Yeah.
Ezra Pound?
Well, he's got this, the line about the kid who comes out of the child came out of the two towers, and then one or two lines later, you've got people who are having their goods sequestered, eyes torn out. I mean, to put a child next to, you know, these scenes of deprivation, you know, or violence.
But it could be argued that Kaplan, the Pound, really is reporting what he thinks he saw,
or
right?
Richard,
he saw a girl when he visited Burgos and was sure that she was the same girl.
He's actually taking this directly from the poema de Le Cid. So, in fact, the other genre that you didn't mention is translation, because my Cid rode up to Burgos, and this kind of introduction already in the cantos of this typically Poundian use of "and," which is the "and" of historical chronicle. It starts in the third line, "and were not those girls, and the Buchan Toro, and the lit cross beams, and peacocks, and from the apple, and there are gods, and in the water." And then it continues, those "ands" continues. These are actually where Hemingway found his "ands." It's in reading the cantos.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's those "ands," which are also related to, they're not necessarily purely narrative.
And sometimes the opposite. They stand in for cause and effect,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, they're just sort of copulative.
They're copulative.
They're paratechnic.
But he's translating here, and what's interesting is that, so he knows the text. We know from this little travel account that he wrote to Burgos, being Ezra Pound, when you read the poem, you go visit the place, and he goes, visits the place, and he actually thinks he sees the same little girl on the street who actually, so this is how something perjures through history, and
who does what, Richard? Who dares to read the edict so that Cid has a leg up on what's facing
him?
Well,
who dares? She
risks
all, right? She risks offering hospitality, which is one of the great themes of the cantos, as it is in the Odyssey, to the banished, to the wanderer.
And he sees, he fixes on her big black eyes, which gets reproduced in the poem. So back to Kaplan about manipulative. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, he saw the girl, he thinks she's the same one, and now we get to the poem. You want to say what it is that, is it that irks you, or
oh,
that
it's not irks
finds
me. No,
you
I'm
emotionally
just,
involved?
Yeah, no.
He's killing girls.
I just...
Maybe she was the one girl instead of...
But it is
others.
It is directly from that... It is directly, you know, a kind of a translation of an episode in the Cid.
But I would question directness in terms of translation, just because there's always going to be choice involved. And we've already got this strong eye that fronts the poem, so that the translator is not transparent, and there are still choices in that "and."
My Cid rode up to Burgos, up to the studded gate between two towers, beat with his lance butt, and the child came out, una niña de 9 años, to the little gallery over the gate between the towers, reading the writ voce tenula, let no man speak to feed help proidias. Unpained have his heart out, set on a pike spike, and both his eyes torn out, and all his goods sequestered. And here, Mio Cid, are the seals, the big seal, and the writing.
The recording we have.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
He's now, you know, it's almost 60 years later, and of the few poems he chose to read in this recording, which was at Spoleto, I believe, mm-hmm. He chooses to read this one. Should we read something into that? I'm moved by the voice of this recording. Would you, Kaplan, like to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways to consider it. I mean, you could think about him as physiologically old. It's tough maybe for him to sustain a 2.5 minute reading. But there's
How old was he?
81.
66. 81.
He was 81. So he sounds a little frailer than a lot of 81-year-olds I know. But I assume that was part of the performance. But
I don't want to discount the idea that there's still a performative aspect to it as he's reading it.
And
one thing that's missing is some of the way he would have a kind of sing-song voice in his early cantos. If you listen to other recordings on Pinsound, that way of reading that's just one step away from humming or incantation, that mm-hmm. seems to be missing in this version. Mm-hmm. And my question would be how much he might be looking at the fact that, okay, you know, William Carlos Williams, the vernacular has won. It's the 1960s. It's after Olson. It's after Creeley. Maybe we need to change our reading style if we're going to be a poem that stays present and relevant into the future. You know, you've got to trade in your old reading style for something a little more modern. I mean, contemporary, I'm wondering.
So he's being strategic in the reading, do you think?
Yeah, maybe, because, you know, anybody listening to the old kind of "and down they went," you know, kind of reading, you know, would hear somebody who's truly dated, who is truly back in 1915 and 1970, not a poem that's going to last 1,000 years.
But I think this reading is truly dated. He really sounds Victorian. He sounds like Yeats, actually.
He does sound like Yeats.
Kind of a cross between the incantatory Yeats and the incantatory Eliot. The poetry voice, a loathsome poetry voice that people use when they read poetry.
Yeah. It's still there, I would say, a little bit, but it's a lot less than those older recordings.
Look, we could talk about this canto or any canto forever. What I want to do is invite you each to say one last thing as we go around, just to have at least the pretense of wrapping up this already very good reading of the poem. Kaplan, do you want to start? What's a last thought?
A last thought. This? Yeah. I listened to the poem a couple times, and I agree with everything that's been said. You can still hear the incantatory voice, but I do think there's some places where he doesn't quite articulate every single word, and it's a little difficult, or maybe it's just difficult to hear on the recording. But certain words, I want to say, do stand out. Like when he says pawnbrokers, that one, you almost feel like he speeds up a little bit, and he says, oh, wait a minute, there's a real argument in this poem. I need to make sure that it
gets
across.
You mean passing over it?
I think there's a slight stress on some words. And
he's remembering the anti-Semitism of the moment, maybe?
Maybe.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Rachel.
It's really hard for me to say one thing, except that perhaps going back to the genre question and the question of who is the hero, it seems to me the cantos are really the invention of a new cultural institution, which is somewhere between a lot of things, between criticism and poetry, between documentary and fact, which differ in Pound's case quite drastically, and between a lot of things. It's really a major collage poem of which one part is never the only thing that can be found there.
Thank you, Richard.
My little punctum is the Inés de Castro, who comes in very at the end, very, very surprisingly. And just very quickly, this is the story Montherlant did his La Reine Morte about, this very famous story of Pedro's wife who was murdered by King Alfonso IV. And when Pedro succeeds at power, he sets up his dead queen, and all the courtiers are forced to come and kiss her hand and kiss the hand of this corpse. This is the absolute sort of fetishization of female beauty and an extraordinary moment. It comes back at the end of Canto 30. After Ignez was murdered, came the lords in Lisboa, a day and a day in homage, seated there, dead eyes, dead hair, under the crown, the king still young there beside her. And actually, it's at the very end of the Usura canto, bringing corpses to banquet. This seems to me sort of the real danger, if this is a poem about the past, the danger of absolutely fetishizing your object of desire into this corpse you talked about. And that's where the last line, nec spe nec meto, which means with neither hope nor fear, which is this motto in the rooms of Isabella d'Este in the Ducal Palace of Mantua, with neither hope nor fear, that motto means act without hope nor fear. The poem actually ends with a rejection of the ultimate example of the fetishized past, which is putting up corpses and adoring absolutely dead things.
I'm sorry. Go ahead,
Mussolini. What about the dead body of Mussolini and the Pisan cantos?
Well, the point is that's already, that's a big problem throughout the cantos. That it's already, you're absolutely right.
He doesn't solve it.
Another genre circus here, because the cantos is also a series of murder stories.
Yeah.
Canto 30 and then Pisan cantos. My final word is very simple, and having not nearly the sophisticated reading of that family motto that ends this poem. At all. When I went back to this, I rediscovered, as we sometimes do in our old copies of Pound's poems, the first time we tried to grapple with this. I was a graduate student at the University of Virginia, and I found Neither Hope Nor Fear written in bold letters in my copy of the New Directions Cantos, and I used it as a motto to get me through the cantos. So I'm not sure what that says about me or my teachers at Virginia. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Rachel, what do you recommend these days?
Oh, well, these days I'm still very saturated in the long poem because of a course that I'm co-teaching with somebody at Penn, Bob Perlman. So I would highly recommend Langston Hughes's Montage of a Dream Deferred, H.D.'s trilogy, and Williams Patterson, not so much as antidotes to Pound, but as juxtapositions with them. So I feel that I haven't read anything current except maybe Jonathan Franzen, the new novel. So I would, in the poetry world, that's what I'm going to rest on.
Sounds great. Sounds like paradise, actually. And also taking a course with you and Bob together sounds like paradise, too.
Definitely.
Kaplan Harris, gather some paradise.
Okay, I'm going to mention Karen McCormick's new book, Tale of Light, New and Selected Poems, 1984 to 2009, published by Book Thug and Westhouse Books. It's a selection of her work that's I'm quite enjoyed reading. It's investigations of language, place, bodies. And I'll just read one line from it, which is from one of the prefaces. It says, an interesting, if frightening, fact is that there are fewer typos in vogue than in most scholarly books published in North America. So,
fantastic. And my paradise is, I'm holding it in my hand. It's a brand new, shiny, New Directions paperback, Ezra Pound, New Selected Poems and Translations, edited by Richard Seaberth. It's just out, and it is priced at under $16, so everybody needs to get a copy of that. Well, that's all the expensive gondolas we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Richard Seaberth, Kaplan Harris, and Rachel Blau Duplessis, and to Poem Talk's engineer today, Steve McLaughlin, and to our editor, as always, the selfsame Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Bert Kimmelman, Marcella Durand, and Aaron Gauci convene to talk about the eco-poetics of Nathaniel Tarn. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that or another Poem Talk.